This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 38, Pride Cometh Before the Fall. As the People's Action Party's first year in power came to a close in May 1960, they were riding high. They had won widespread plaudits, made important improvements to Singapore, and they were popular. One year later, they were absolutely crushed, destroyed in a crucial by-election, which party leader Lee Kuan Yew had declared to be a referendum on his government. The rapid decline of the PAP throughout its second year was in part due to the same tendencies which had initially made them so popular. They leapt ahead, introducing new policies at a breakneck speed, but with minimal consultation. In the first year, when the problems were obvious and the solutions worked out beforehand while in opposition, the PAP could get away with working so quickly and not following a consultative process. They could also blame problems on the previous government. By the second year, the problems were no longer so obvious. Neither were the solutions. They needed time to be worked out. And the PAP was no longer the revolutionary party. They were no longer the party of change. They were quickly becoming the status quo party. But the PAP leaders continued to barrel ahead, disregarding the objections of experts or members of their own party. Worse, they lashed out at people who disagreed in stark, hostile terms. And over time, this caused the party leadership to lose the support of many of their party members. Their failure to solve problems, or indeed their causing of new problems, led to growing unhappiness among the public. Two episodes ago, I talked about the arrogance and high-handedness of Goh Keng Swee, Toh Chin Chye, Rajaratnam and Lee Kuan Yew. Their contempt and condescension for their colleagues, their refusal to operate using the normal established channels of government, and indeed their undermining of the independence of many government agencies and the steady increase in arbitrary executive power, and their refusal to consult people who knew more about the subject than they did. All this behavior angered and infuriated the members of the PAP, especially many of the elected members. As an elected representative of the people, and a member of the government, how can you do your job properly if the party leadership refuses to tell you what is going on, refuses to consult you on how your constituency would feel about proposed policy, and treats you merely like a foot soldier, just there to vote yes on government legislation? Yours not to question why, yours but to do or die. Last week, we dealt with the issue of detention without trial and how it was the fundamental issue which drove the split in the PAP. This week, we deal with the issues which precipitated the split, which chiefly was a lack of internal party democracy and consultation, or to put it another way, the arrogance of the PAP leadership. It was, in fact, the PAP leaders themselves who caused the split and affected their own standing with the public through their own actions. And their downfall starts with how they treated the most popular politician in Singapore, the former mayor of Singapore, Ong Eng-Guan. As unhappiness within the PAP grew over the party leaders' behavior and all the mistakes they were making and how they were responding to honest constructive criticism, it was Ong Eng-Guan, now the Minister for National Development, who sought to rally people who were angry about Lee's leadership. Ong had lost the PAP Central Executive Committee vote to select the Prime Minister, only because of Party Chairman Toh Chin Chye's casting vote. The 1958 Public Attitudes Survey found that among PAP supporters, Ong Eng-Guan was more popular than Lee Kuan Yew. Ong had been so close to the prime ministership, and he knew it. The problem was that Ong was not as popular within the party as he was outside it. Both the PAP's right and left wings were cautious of him. They saw him as a self-promoter. They felt he was not as competent as the leadership of the right or the left. And so for Lee Kuan Yew, Ong was a potential rival and a threat, and Lee had desired to eliminate him for a while. So Lee quietly began to gather support to move against Ong and eliminate him as a rival. Now, when he got wind of this, in response, Ong Eng Guan tabled 16 resolutions at the PAP party conference, designed to counter the accusations and win the support of the party at large, especially of the unhappy PAP progressive left. They included demands for the release of political detainees, immediate talks on merger with the Federation, the lowering of consumption taxes, and greater intra-party democracy. Many party members were really sympathetic to these resolutions. They agreed with them, but they also saw Ong as an opportunist. And party unity was important. Divisions in the party could be exploited by the colonial forces. Anti-colonialism first, politics later. So, to cut a long story short, Ong was sandbagged at the party conference and was subsequently expelled on the 27th of July 1960 with two other PAP members, S.V. Lingam and Ng Teng Kian. They formed the United People's Party, the UPP, and crossed to sit with the opposition. But it did not end there. The UPP had only 3 votes. The PAP had 40 in the Legislative Assembly. But the PAP leaders could just not leave it alone. They had to crush Ong. And so for the next several months, the business of government was put on hold as Ong and the PAP leadership quarrelled in the Legislative Assembly. Ong alleged corruption in the PAP government. The PAP leadership abused their powers by ordering Special Branch to dig up dirt on Ong. Allegations of perjury, dishonesty and bigamy by Ong were leaked to the press. A commission of inquiry was created to examine Ong's allegations, but before it could meet, Ong resigned his seat and challenged the government to a by-election. The Commission of Inquiry into Ong's allegations finally reached its conclusion in February 1961 and found them to be baseless. But by this time, everyone was thoroughly sick of the issue. Chua Seng Kim, better known by her married name of Mrs. Seow Peck Ling, was the SPA's, Singapore People's Alliance's, Assemblyman for Mountbatten. And she declared that the public was, quote, fed up with this ex-PAP versus PAP quarrel. For 2 months, the public have had that rammed down their throats, unquote. And the press was sick of it too. The Sin Chew Jit Po commented that, quote, a stable political environment is the chief condition for a state to be well developed and maintained. The good of the people first, competition between parties second. Now, this phrase was deliberately chosen because it originated from a PAP policy speech delivered by Ong Eng Guan back in 1958 when they were in opposition, declaring their intention to work peacefully with all groups for the betterment of Singapore, regardless of political affiliation, declaring their intention to work for anti-colonialism first, to set aside politics for the good of the people. Publicly, the affair was seen as an internal PAP matter. The PAP's failure to manage its own family had led to its dirty linen being washed in public, with the business of government neglected as a result. The Nanyang Shangbao reminded politicians that the struggle against colonialism was of the utmost priority. The execution of Patrice Lumumba just a month before underlined the need for unity, not just because of the murder of a popularly elected anti-colonial leader, but because he had been labelled as a communist. The Nanyang Shangbao wrote, quote, when the Belgian government and its immigrants discovered that Lumumba could not be fully made use of, they forcibly put a red cap on his head. It noted how divisions between the parties and in the parties in the Congo had been exploited. It was a reminder of the fragility of Singapore democracy. Divisive events like the Ong Eng Guan affair and the throwing around of accusations of communism would leave Singapore open to exploitation by external forces, by colonial forces. Unity was paramount. The PAP, however, ignored all attempts at conciliation. On the contrary, it made clear that it considered the by-election a referendum on the PAP government. This was a risky strategy. Despite its torrents of new policies, it had yet to deliver concrete improvements in the crucial areas of jobs and housing. Singapore's economy had lost a further 8,600 jobs, even as 10,400 new people joined the workforce in 1961. Trade had fallen in 1961. The trade deficit expanded sharply from 468 million to 601 million. Industrialization plans remained only on paper. Violent crime and secret society activity had fallen, but non-violent crime had risen. And the HDB had only built 1,682 buildings in 1960, almost the same number as the much maligned Singapore Improvement Trust built in 1959. The Nanta situation had stagnated. The university was in financial crisis, while the government Nanta Liaison Committee argued. Suspicion and distrust of the government's intentions towards Chinese education had returned. Chaos had ensued from botched reforms implemented by the PAP government. The implementation of government plans showed a marked bias towards English schools. Indeed, by May 1961, the Chinese press was again asking if the government was biased against vernacular schools. And these failures were credited to the PAP leadership's unwillingness to accept debate and criticism and the lack of effective opposition in the Legislative Assembly. The Nanyang Shangbao wrote, quote, "Less worrisome than a mistake itself is a lack of self-examination and willingness to accept criticism. If the government frequently engages in self-examination and is receptive to criticism, then more experience will translate into more confidence, more frustrations will result in greater efforts. Confidence and effort are the only way to success," unquote. So it wasn't only the PAP members who were unhappy with the arrogance of the party leadership. It was now being widely acknowledged in the press and by the public as a problem. And the press expressed hopes that the PAP would listen. But they were disappointed. On the 12th of March, 1961, the PAP introduced their candidate for the Hong Lim by-election, Jek Yen Tong, the Prime Minister's political secretary. He was a puzzling choice. He was a Cantonese speaker in an overwhelmingly Hokkien constituency, facing Ong Eng Guan, a formidable Hokkien orator with well-established grassroots links. Jack's nomination did nothing to suggest that the PAP was reaching out to new voices, soliciting new ideas. Many PAP leaders, including some in the Central Executive Committee, professed befuddlement and ignorance as to the leadership's strategy. But what they didn't realize was that Lee Kuan Yew was appealing to a different audience. He was not appealing to the voters. Jack's nomination was meant to appeal to the Malayan Communist Party. His anti-colonial credentials were impeccable. He was a former political detainee. So an MCP directive went out ordering followers to support Jek Yen Tong. The MCP leader in Singapore, Fong Chong Pik, wrote Lee a letter assuring Lee that the Malayan Communist Party was fully behind Lee Kuan Yew, fully behind the PAP. Lee's conspiracy with the MCP was alive and well. And so the PAP leadership accordingly ignored concerns about its style of government and instead couched their election rhetoric in terms calculated to appeal to communists or what they thought would appeal to communists. On the very first night of campaigning, Lee Kuan Yew starkly described the election as a, quote, "struggle between righteousness and evil, between truth and falsehood." Ong had switched from extreme left to extreme right, unquote. Jek Yen Tong accused Ong of deserting a united movement to spread lies. The PAP leadership really believed in this ace card up their sleeve. Jek Yen Tong privately told Dr. Po Soo Kai that he would win because the underground was on his side. Lee Kuan Yew, confident of victory, pledged to resign and call fresh elections if the PAP lost the Hong Lim by-election. This threat, however, had little impact on the public mood. A loss in Hong Lim would still leave the PAP with an overwhelming majority in the assembly. The public saw the Hong Lim by-election as a sordid, vindictive, internal PAP affair, and the lack of participation by the other political parties confirmed this. Ong, meanwhile, campaigned on the basis of his record in Hong Lim and his 16 resolutions. As mayor, and then later as Minister of National Development, he had improved economic conditions in Hong Lim, increasing street lamps and standpipes, issuing more hawker and taxi licenses, and so on. He criticized increases in consumption taxes, which had hit the working class hard. He condemned the government for housing shortages and growing unemployment. He demanded an easing of regulations for the entry of relatives from China, which was a particularly popular proposal. He called for merger and an end to colonialism. He presented a very different image, dressing in simple clothes, sitting by the roadside and eating with his constituents, talking over with them their concerns and issues. Lee Kuan Yew, by contrast, was very stiff and aloof and did not shake hands with people. The PAP left were caught between them. While they personally did not support Ong Eng Guan, they agreed with many of his resolutions. They were unhappy with the lack of internal party democracy and the government's policies regarding political detainees in the Internal Security Council, and Chinese education, and the trade union movement, and citizenship. And furthermore, they had been repeatedly attacked and insulted in Petir and the other PAP publications. Lim Chin Siong, as their leader, sought conciliation. He wanted to redirect the government's energy back towards the platform it had been elected on. At a trade union meeting in Victoria Hall on 23rd March, he urged the 1,000 attendees to remain united despite personal disagreements. Lim argued that anti-colonialism was the priority. Colonialism was the opponent, not each other. Petty infighting would do no good when there was a country to govern. Ong's resolutions reflected the desires of the people, but he had adopted them out of ambition and so should not be supported. The meeting passed resolutions reflecting Lim's concerns. The next day, his speech was reported in the English press as a call to end the Internal Security Council. While the Chinese press dwelt on his themes of conciliation, the need for united government, and the government's responsibility to govern, not engage in infighting. Straits Times journalism. Some things never change. When we return, the result of the Hong Lim by-election. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Tham. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, Pride Cometh Before the Fall. On 29th of April 1961, the PAP suffered a devastating defeat in the Hong Lim by-election. Ong Eng Guan defeated Jek Yen Thong by 7,747 votes to 2,820. Winning by a margin of nearly 50%. The Chinese press reported that people had been turned off by the PAP's negative campaigning. The people's concerns about democratic government and the economy had not been addressed. The PAP, having campaigned as if the Hong Lim by-election was a referendum on their authority, now found themselves bound by their own rhetoric. They threatened to call a general election. The party newsletter, Petir, editorialized that, quote, "If the result of the Hong Lim by-election accurately reflects the feelings of the people of Singapore, then it would be immoral and impractical for the PAP government to cling to office," unquote. The loss was a massive shock to Lee. Privately, he wondered whether the MCP underground was really so weak that it had been unable to swing the election result, or whether it had simply turned against them. He got an answer quickly. Fong Chong Pik, concerned that Lee would conclude that the MCP had gone back on their word, met with Lee again to reassure him. On the 11th of May 1960, they met again and talked for almost 4 hours. Fong was desperate to reassure Lee that the underground was still strong and that their alliance was still intact. He argued for continued cooperation. Li, however, refused to commit himself. As midnight neared, he got up and left. The Li Kuan Yew MCP conspiracy was over. The PAP's progressive left, meanwhile, felt events had justified their arguments. The voters of Hong Lim had decisively rejected the PAP's performance in office thus far. If the PAP wanted to continue in power, they had to refocus on the platform they had been elected on and keep their election promises. But the leadership would not take their advice. They felt frustrated at the lack of intra-party democracy and consultation and their marginalization within the party. Li Kuan Yew sent a letter of resignation to party chairman Toh Chin Chai, an offer that was well publicized in Singapore. His intention was calculated to appear penitent while reaffirming his mandate as prime minister. The PAP's Central Executive Committee duly turned down his resignation, asking only that he learn from his mistakes. A review committee was formed to study the reasons for their failure in Hong Lim. It was chaired by Goh Keng Swee with Lee Siew Cho as secretary. Dr. Lee Siew Cho, the assemblyman for Queenstown, argued that the electoral defeat was due to the failure of the PAP to keep its promises. The government was dictatorial, and its ministers had lost touch with public opinion. He argued for the need for self-criticism and to rectify these mistakes. The leadership's obsession with communism was obscuring its view of the important issues of anti-colonialism, merger, jobs, and housing. He pleaded with Li Kuan Yew, quote, "Why quibble about communists and non-communists when we have the same objectives?" Unquote. Many in the PAP leadership agreed that they had become dangerously out of touch with the voters. But Li Kuan Yew was in charge. He was not willing to consult the left. On the contrary, British Commissioner Lord Selkirk was taken aback by what he called, quote, "Li's dangerous obsession with Lim Chin Siong," unquote, and the degree to which Li Kuan Yew blamed Lim Chin Siong for his failures. Lord Selkirk was not unduly worried about the PAP, but he was concerned about the PAP leadership's behaviour. They refused to admit responsibility for mistakes, blamed their failures on a wide variety of enemies, everyone but themselves, and refused to listen to constructive feedback. Selkirk lamented, quote, "The PAP has chiefly fallen down over their complete failure to understand the mechanics of successful democratic government," unquote. And in particular, he worried about Lee Kuan Yew's fragility, his mental imbalance, and his tendency to panic. And so did many of the PAP backbenchers. Li Kuan Yew was becoming a liability. His brilliance was accompanied with a dangerous paranoia and fragility, which was leading him to crack under pressure. They were aware of Li's offer to resign, and so they began to consider the possibility that Li and the rest of the leadership would not deviate from its path and would eventually cause the PAP to lose power. Something had to be done to keep the PAP in power, to attune the PAP to popular opinion, to return the PAP to its election platform and keep their promises for the good of the party, for the good of Singapore. And so dissent spread among the PAP backbenchers. They speculated that the Lee Kuan Yew group had reached the end of their effectiveness. They won the war, but maybe they were losing the peace. And maybe the PAP would be better off under different leadership. The parliamentary secretaries met privately to discuss what would happen if Lee Kuan Yew resigned. In such a scenario, his team would likely go with him. And in that case, an orderly succession had to be planned. There could not be a power vacuum in Singapore. And both the British colonial authorities and the PAP's members were right to worry. Because to keep himself in power, Li would embark on the most desperate gamble of his political career. Keep in mind that he still had an overwhelming majority in the Legislative Assembly, but he was responding as if he was on the verge of disaster. he decided that to win back control of the party, he needed to find and monopolize an issue which was universally popular, an issue on which he could win the next election. And by monopolizing this issue, he could then use it to fix his rivals, forcing them to submit to his authority or go against public opinion. And the solution that he settled on, his chosen solution to this problem, was one which would change the lives of every single person in Malaya and British Borneo. It would set off massive shocks which continue to reverberate around all of Malaysia to this day. It would spark off racial hostility, provoke division, lead to mutual antagonism between the leaders of Malaya's communities, and upset the delicate balance of race and religion and political power in Malaya. To keep himself in power, in response to a threat that barely existed, Lee Kuan Yew would betray the hopes and dreams of his colleagues, his friends, his people. To win the next election, Lee Kuan Yew would rush headlong into the merger of Singapore with the Federation of Malaya. And this would be a mistake he would regret for the rest of his life. Join us next week as we enter the final phase of Singapore's independence, the road to merger. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjfell. Thank you very much and see you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.